Hey, good morning, Chris. How are you?
Morning, Roland. I am well.
Okay, so let me just say that both you and I went back and forth a little bit this week, and neither one of us, I think, were in a really good, positive, happy space. Is that correct?
It was
Is
I
it
was having some feels for sure.
something you want to talk about on the podcast?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, it's I can definitely speak to what the week looked like and some of the bumps, some of the bumps that played out. Oh, you want me to throw down first?
Sure, I
I
mean, I'm trying to be polite here.
no, that's awesome. It's a thing that happens, I guess. So my colleague and I, we often talk about some of the challenges in closing up the semester. And we've just kind of shortened it down to talking about being a closer. And sometimes we'll use the sports analogy, like it's you're trying to get the buzzer beaters done, or it's the last few minutes to play in this period kind of a thing. And some of the skills that are necessary to, let's say from a teacher's perspective, for to be able to close strong, they sometimes escape you. And from where she and I are working with the students, there's a direct translation to supporting the students to try and close strong. And you start to feel some of the, I guess, the tensions of trying to get them there. And I think was it last week we were talking about planning stuff. Are you a contingency or a redundancy planner? And it's funny, neither one of them in particular styles of planning help you because everything is just so in the moment. Like you're just kind of landing on task to task, conversation to conversation. Like it's so in the moment helping the kids. In some cases, they're transitioning back to their home schools. In some cases, they're just trying to wrap up their culminating activity. But the biggest eye opener sometimes is the for some of the students that I work with, and this I've found even prior to this, not every student has the tools to close a semester successfully, whether or not they're just fatigued, like teachers could be, or some of their patterns of behavior in not completing tasks are now kind of wrapping back around. And they're hitting culminating activities, and they start to realize something that maybe was observed and the feedback was there the whole time, but they're starting to realize they're missing some pieces in order to kind of get whatever that thing is, the mark, the success, that thing that will make them feel like they can walk away. And it just, if the semesters could be a marathon or a sprint, and you're constantly flowing kind of through the whole semester, I find time and time again, you hit the end of the semester and it can feel like mountain climbing, like almost straight up. It can feel like free falling, like skydiving. And it's just, there's just a fatigue cost. And when I reached out, that's where I was trying to figure out, God, it's like deja vu because it happens every semester, every semester. So that's the space that we were in. It was that, when the kids in class are on edge trying to wrap up their stuff, and then you as the support, the teacher, the mentor, the counselor are trying to sort of keep them balanced, and then you get off balance, and in some ways, that's what becomes, I guess, the decoded part is that it starts to get outside the classroom. It can't stay in the walls, so you make it out into the halls. Heaven help, meeting up with another teacher in the hallway that's in the exact same state, because then it trickles up from there. And then even worse, if you happen to still be talking about it when you all make it out to the car, because then you keep on talking out there, and then somehow you're thinking about it on the drive home, and then somehow you make it home and you're supposed to be in a space where it's like, okay, now let's just take it down a notch and exist at home, and you're still thinking, ah, how can I? Then you go to bed and wake up and do it all over. That was the space.
Well, I'm glad you reached out because I thought I was the only one losing my mind. And I guess maybe it's not fair to say that you were losing your mind, but it's nice to know that I wasn't the only one. And I want to comment about what you're talking about closing out the semester. I'm going to use the word sabotage. I've had lots of students over the years that go strong, and then at the end of a unit or whatever we're finishing up, they sabotage it because there's something about their makeup, there's something about the way they operate daily, habitually, that they don't do well with success. They don't want it, they're not used to it, or whatever the case is, or they're so busy failing all the time in their mind that there's no other option. And so it's easier for me in elementary school because I don't have a semester that closes out the same way yours does. And every now and again, I don't tell certain kids that they're working on a culminating activity. And I know that might sound harsh, but if you know the child and you know how to work with them, you have to do what's best for them. And sometimes what's best for them is not knowing that this is the final thing that you might do around a particular subject or topic. So I don't tell them, because when I do, all of a sudden there's a meltdown, or there's resistance and there's defiance. And it's like, you know, you got this far. I don't understand. Well, I do understand why you don't want to take it to the next level, but let's just avoid all that sometimes. So I get it. My space was a little bit different. I think I was just tired of certain behavior at that point in time earlier on this week. And I thought to myself, in my mind, I was ready. I was ready to give up all my rights as an individual and ask someone to strap a body camera onto me, because it was one of these moments where you're dealing with a situation and the student you're working with is being completely rude, completely disrespectful. You know, it appears as though it comes out of left field. I have, you know, educational assistants in the room that are seeing this happen. They're participating in it. And it's like, nobody would ever believe me. Nobody would ever believe that this happened, that this exchange occurred. Because, you know, how could a kid do something that is just so, like, out there? And so I thought to myself, you know what, I just put the camera on me now. Because when I make the call to the parents, I want to be able to say, you know, this is what happened. Come on in. I will show you what happened. It's like, it's in color. I have it. You need to see my response. You need to see their response. You need to see how this whole thing played out. And can we figure out how to work on this so that we can reduce this type of behavior? Because it's just not acceptable. In my mind, somewhere rattling in my mind is a place where it doesn't matter to me what your infliction is. At some point, you're a human and you need to work with other humans, and you need to do it in a way that is relatively social and safe. And I'm not saying you can't get angry, but it's the way you talk to people. Like, I just couldn't believe some of the ways I was being spoken to. And just totally, like, I'm looking around, like, did I miss something here? You know, me asking you to do whatever is something I've asked you to do since September, and your response is completely out of whack. And it's part and parcel of being a teacher. So, you know, to any veterans who are listening, they're probably thinking, come on, Chidiac, pull up your socks. This happens. I get that it happens. But when you build a community and you have expectations that are agreed upon on both sides, just sometimes things just come right out. I'll put it this way. Even the students in my room who are more susceptible to being rude, to getting upset easily, and frustration overwhelms them, even they were looking at the situation like, what's going on over there? Why is that person talking to the adults that way? When they, like, what's going on here? And I know it's deeper, right? Like, as I tell you this story, I think of Jonathan Soh and his reading and work around Shanker's work around self-regulation. So I know there's answers here. I know it runs deep. I'm not saying it doesn't, I'm just saying that I wish that I had something to record this interaction, because people may believe it doesn't happen. It happens, and it takes away from instructional time, and it damages the community, and it does a whole bunch of things that people don't tend to think about when they think about education. They just have a visualization in their mind of a teacher standing in front of a bunch of kids, teaching, and the kids are just taking it all in, and everything's hunky-dory, and that's not the way it goes all the time. And so that was my text to you about, I'm ready for the body camera. That's where it came from. And your advice was good. Everybody listening, Chris, the first thing he said was, what happened? The second thing was, sleep on it. So after I tossed my phone across the room, I left it alone, and that was it.
It's your experience this week, and that coupled with a couple other thoughts got me. And so I put out a poll on Twitter. It was I was at an event back in October, and I met this dude, Kevin Cardo, and he's involved in education out on the West Coast. And he did a couple things when I was talking to him. He mentioned a project out there called the Foundry. I believe I'm saying that right, the Foundry. And then he also kind of got into my personal dictionary, the word co-location. And I mean, it seems simple, the blending of the two word pieces, but then I started looking into co-location, and it in the particular, in his case, when he was talking about the Foundry, but in the sort of broader sense of education, it's kind of a frame of having multiple essential services all put in the same place. So out on the West Coast, you have this project where there's some pretty cool support systems for, I think it's for teens, maybe up to age 24. And he was talking about what a great model that was, because it not only provided, I mean, its idea of building success for teens is not just based on the fact that they need an education, but they might need other essential services. It could be job support, it could be mental wellness, it could be healthcare. And it got me thinking about that in our context in the schools, where you and I have touched on this before, where the school, everything is everything, and having to sort of spread those where the obvious classroom or community needs are not, they're not dovetailing really well with the actual supports that are needed. And so you end up with sort of like these kind of broken gaps in the web. And the reality is that more students are still coming in, and the teachers need support, and the schools need support. So I put out a poll that just asked the question, like, if we're talking about co-location and putting these essential services together with EDU, what does your school need? And, you know, when you put a poll out on Twitter, you can only poll four. But I threw down, you know, healthcare. Like, does it need some sort of a medical clinic? Does it need counseling services? Does it need an athletic center? Or does it need, and I actually forget my fourth one right now. You don't have an other option. But you got me thinking about that, because it sounds like in your context, this is stuff that you have the classroom as the place that these moments are manifesting. But in order to effectively deal with that, it can't be done in the classroom. It can't be done. I think back to my experience running restaurants, and often I found myself not only writing the playbook, but also have to be on the field at the exact same time. Imagine that in a football game, that you are actually calling out, you're sort of having to design the plays against the offense that, or defense, whatever that you're going against, and you're kind of making it up entirely on the spot. A couple of restaurants I worked with had no playbook. Like, they didn't even have formalized recipes, but they were open and running, and you're sort of managing staff. And that's really complex if there isn't a clear method to get to a certain dish, and the possibility that it could turn out differently every single time. So I think about education sometimes, and how I do feel like we're in that space sometimes where the expectation to come up with the creative response while you're in the trenches, I get it, that happens. I get it, and you address that too. I get it, it happens. But the constant reliance on that creativity when it's under duress can put you in a space, I think, where, well, I'll say where I was this past week, and definitely where it read like you were as well. So that credit you for throwing the phone, getting it out of your way, getting the tool of destruction out of your hands, and taking some digital downtime.
You know, it's also that I wasn't mentally prepared, I guess, for that interaction. And so, you know, it's a lot more difficult when you're being reactive. So like after talking to you and kind of coming down from the whole thing, you know, now for the rest of the week, I was kind of, I was ready. It's just the whole thing throws you off and you can't always be prepared for something like that. The whole thing just seemed to be so wonky, especially when you feel like you've helped build something that's running really well. Like, it's like you're driving your car and you just had it at the mechanics and they just looked it over, changed your oil. They checked everything out, everything was fine. Then all of a sudden you're driving down the street, you hit the brakes and something pops right out of the car. Like something just breaks. And you're like, I was there a couple of days ago, everything was fine. And now it's completely wrecked. I can't even use it, right? And then all of a sudden you're being reactive, whereas you thought you were being proactive by setting up all these things. And I get it, things come up all the time in school, you know, some good, some bad. But I guess it was the perfect storm, right? Like my head is wrapped around report cards. We're doing things and I'm being like ultra sensitive and vigilant to try to capture all the positive things to report on. And it's like, then you have this situation that just pops up and it takes time away from the teaching, the learning. It takes time away from being in a headspace that's good for people. So I don't know, that was that. It's funny because it's not like it's never happened before. Actually, it happens weekly, so I'm not sure what it was about this particular incident, but it happens. And I think it's important for people to hear that it's not just, I don't just stand in front of the kids and talk all day and they just do everything I ask. No, some people do exactly what I ask. Some people won't. And then so you need to discover why, what's going on. Some people start off and then back away. Like three or four times this week, there were situations where I found students doing things they had no business doing. And then when you try to have a conversation about what's going on, you know, they accept no responsibility for their behavior. They turn it around and they start to blame you or other things or other people. And it's like, it just gets old. And it's unfortunate because, you know, we're trying to teach them to be responsible and accountable. And my style, any student that knows me well will tell you that I do really well with the truth. Like when you're honest with me, I do everything I can to build from there. But when you're dishonest, it's that trust that gets busted. And then it takes a while to bring it back. So, yeah, I don't know what to tell you. I just wanted to let you know, Chris, that when you were talking, I was getting some really weird alien static on your end. It irks you. It's the whole tech thing. And so anybody who's watching, Chris is now madly, he was like grabbing cords or whatever, and he's checking all his.
How's his, that? Is that any better?
Oh, that's beautiful. What did you do?
No, I'm not going to even say. I'm just going to pretend. Oh. That, yeah.
No, it's yeah. still there. It's still there.
It's still there. It's
slight. Yeah, when you talk, I hear the buzzing. The aliens are coming.
Serious, eh?
Yeah, there's some. Every time you talk, there's some kind of like static. It's not as bad as it was, but it's still there. I don't know what to tell you, Chris. There's something about you. You have some kind of personality.
Is it completely disruptive? Like we're crushing the audio right now?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's slight. It was a little bit stronger when you were talking earlier. Now it's just slight.
I can try one more switch.
If you want, it's up to you.
Dare I? Okay, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens here. Let me pop this.
I mean, truly, no podcast episode is completely perfect unless Chris is messing around with his switches and his headphones and mic.
Can you hear my audio again?
I can hear your audio.
How does it sound now?
We still have the aliens.
Serious, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, everything is set as it should.
So I don't know, maybe it's just me. Like, maybe I just hear it and it doesn't exist outside of my headphones.
I love it. Now somehow you're just messing with me. But I'm not. Okay. I do all these switches, you're like, oh yeah, sorry, no, I didn't have this thing plugged in on my side. So bad, or like, should we keep pushing?
No, we keep pushing.
Okay. What did you have me thinking about? You had me thinking about the, I like your line about the truth, and making sure, like I often find myself when I'm talking to students and I'm talking to parents, I say flat out, I need for us to be in the same space. And I think that to someone that would just be jumping into, and this could be in one of our intake sessions, it could be the equivalent of like your parent-teacher conversations, right? I think to someone that might be fresh into teaching or fresh into understanding my dynamic, they may feel that I'm being a little too curt. I'm kind of going too close to the bone. But I really expect that from my parents, to be able to be as straight up and clear with me as I'm attempting to be with them. I also find that if I misstep and create a little bit of offense, I feel like at least having my truth of my experience and my connectivity, sometimes with their child, sometimes with the system, just getting it onto the table flat out, it moves things along. You get through the bumpy stuff a lot faster. And whether or not I'm letting them know about, you know, behaviors in the class or expectations around behavior or getting work done or how to navigate the system, if they've sort of been told something and I will flat out say that is not true. And if they sort of say, yeah, but someone told me that, insert someone in EDU. And I said, it may have been true for that person. It may have been true a few years ago, but that's not where the current documentation is. So constantly trying to crystallize and make clear what's happening right there at the table when you're having that conversation. And I think it's a big challenge. I think sometimes the politeness and it can be a little bit of fear at the table to sort of be able to speak directly to what's in front of you. I too have been in those moments where, you know, I think about my own children in school as well. And some of the challenges that have been put to me as a parent, not as a teacher. And one of my immediate responses is, but that's not what they're like at home. And you go in that frame, and that's a really delicate conversation to sort of put to any teacher from a parent, because if you exist there too long, you're in complete denial of the other person's context. You're not really taking into account the fact that away from you, I understand my child is trying to figure out, both my children are trying to figure out the world with the tools that they have. And if I somehow suggest that the way that they problem solve and the way that they explore the world with me and my spouse and our family unit, if I dare to suggest that that's the exact same way that it works at school, then you automatically just are not getting it. Like, you can't have a conversation. I think the challenge there is to, one, to share evidence. Sharing evidence is really tricky because it becomes so context specific, especially if you don't have the language to speak to it or the opportunity. And I think that's what's cracking off with you this week. You're observing things that are very, like, it is so obvious, but it's happening inside of a small space and there's no opportunity to speak as directly to it as you are experiencing it in that moment. You can have a parent-teacher interview, you can talk to an admin, but as soon as it moves away from the actual impact zone, it starts to get a little diffused. And, you know, I've worked very hard that when I'm conferencing with my kids' teachers, that I soak it in and I have to walk away from the table. I try not to share too much. I just try and take the whole context that they're presenting to me, because I've really come to understand that my children are different when they're away from me. And there's, and when they are away from me, I can only expect that they use the tools that are at their disposal. And if they've got good tools, it could turn out good. It could still be a good tool used in a bad way. And I think about this for my teaching context where stuff happened, like the things that you're saying about being spoken to and some of the attitude and some of the behavior. I get that as well. They're just 15, 16, 17, 18 year olds. Sometimes I have the opportunity when there's an outburst or some moment happens where I can say to the kid, okay, now what? And we can do it as sort of like a problem solving. You've done this thing. You realize that that thing that you've said in some context could have got you suspended again. And we can go there, because even my program working with students that are on suspension and expulsion, you can be suspended and expelled from our program. So yeah, that element is there, right? But as an end game, if we're not pausing for that moment for us, if we're not pausing for that moment and kind of being clear and sometimes really uncomfortable, because if you've been called out multiple times with an F-bomb, it is hard to dig down and turn that into a therapeutic rapport mentorship moment, you know. And I'll bring it back to you, especially when you're at the end of the semester too, trying to close out with all the students. Like there's not a lot of resiliency in the bucket to draw from. So I totally get it. I think the most profound thing for me out of what you said, there's a lot there that pinged off for me, but that idea that acceptance, absolute acceptance, that my own children are not who I think they are, what I've come to believe they are when they're away from me. And I have to accept that duality. Sometimes I say to my colleague, I say, everyone's a liar, and she doesn't like that. But I don't mean it in a harsh fashion. I mean, we have to accept this duality and find our way through it. So she says, I'm not a liar. And I say, well, okay. Then she takes it as an affront to her character. I could pick any quality, but that tends to be a good sparking point, because in accepting the fact that someone could be a liar, but also really great at math, or someone's a liar and they're an amazing basketball star. The dimensionality of people is what makes this whole thing, one of the elements that makes this conversation that you and I having really, really complex. And then you have the supports and all the other things that we spoke of too. So, yeah.
For sure, it's so important to try to be aware of the fact that you can hold the same person in two different places, right? Like when my student goes off, that's a really disturbing part of them that's coming out, but it doesn't mean like they're not good writers or they're not really good helpers of technology in the classroom. Like you can hold a person in many different places. They don't just have to be in one place. So after this student had their, I don't know what you want to call it, episode, experience, you know, we try, like you, what's next? How do we move forward here? This is what you did. It needs to be cleaned up somehow, but we still have a full day ahead of us. We still have a lot of things we need to do. We need to both reset and move on. And it's important for me to say that what occurred is not is not the be all and end all for that particular person. Excuse me. It was a blip on the radar in their life that week, right? Like we've all had them. If you and I have an argument and that's it, like it ends at that argument, it'd be so unfortunate, right? Because there's so much that, for example, you and I can do as professionals working together collaboratively, that it'd be a shame to let one little bump in the road interfere with all kinds of amazing things that happen in our interactions. And so I really appreciate you saying that. I like your line that everybody's a liar. And it's too bad that your work partner take such offense to that, but I get where you're coming from. And
she's embraced it. It's funny. She's embraced it because I dropped that, like, I think before Christmas, and she did. So put it this way. She's a behaviorist at heart. She's trained in sociology. She's got her degree. So she's a big observer of behaviors. And I'll say for her, she she is evidence-based and sort of looks at current behaviors as a path from previous behaviors and leading to sort of future behaviors. It's in her skill set to observe human nature that way. And she takes her work, she's so passionate about her work that, and like teachers, let's say all educators, sometimes when we start to talk about, there are topics that when tabled, they don't stay on the table. They go right to someone's heart. So you might start talking about assessment and some random person walks into the room and right away they're on fire. Like you've just totally triggered them, right? So, and it's not to say that their opinion is right or wrong. You've just tapped into that sort of bubbling thing that they need to talk about. And I think this in particular, when I said everyone's a liar, she took it as a more of a negative assessment of people and then took it personally as well. It's like somehow I was saying she was a liar, which I guess I was, because I do believe that people present different sides of themselves depending on who they're connecting with, right? It's that idea of someone being an open book. I don't necessarily believe that they're 100% of an open book all the time. So there's still a context of holding things back. And if some people they might say that that's a really thin definition of being a liar, but I would say that if there's intention to it, if you're holding it, holding back truth with intention, then you're aware that you're lying a little bit. And I guess I can kind of make it gray zone, like it's not such a bad thing, because it'd be really difficult. I've seen that movie, that Jim Carrey movie, and there's another one. Was it The Invention of Lying with Ricky Gervais? They're hilarious movies, but it basically has to do is, you know, how much worse it can be if you're always telling the truth. And so I think she's come to embrace it, but part of it in sort of introducing again like that is the complexity. And we talk about this a lot, about the whole child and the whole student, and we're getting more comfortable talking about the whole teacher, the whole adult in the room. But I don't know if we've gotten any closer to, I don't know if we're sort of cracking open the possibility of understanding each other in that way, but I haven't, I haven't sort of witnessed that harmonizing where I feel like those ideas have really made it to a space that makes sense in a school yet. There still has to be the adult that's kind of the parent for the kids. There's just maybe 30 of them that you're having to parent at any one time, and you don't necessarily get to share the true data with anyone outside of that classroom because of privacy issues and, you know, protecting the minors and such. So it's definitely challenging. It's definitely challenging. And stuff can happen so fast. That's the other thing that you made me think about. We were hanging with friends last night and they're just recounting one of the trips they had to go to emergency with one of their kids. And it's like, one of the reason the kid had to go to, because they put an object in their mouth from the class, and literally the activity was started, the teacher turned to grab something, came back, and the kid had it like blocked, you know, that piece of skin that's sort of between your lip and your top teeth. It was pinched on that. So the student, I know, the kid, the student, my friend's kid, it was sort of like dangling from their mouth, and the teacher turned it. Like, so stuff happens really quick with kids making bizarre decisions that, it's just, that's a whole other challenge in itself. And that's where I was like, I bow to elementary teachers, because I know my son is that type of decision maker. Yeah, my spouse said it best last night, you know, that shiny thing in the corner, you know, not only would my son be there, he'd probably put it there, and he also knows to go back, and he's not going to ask. He's just going to go back and start playing with that shiny thing.
Okay, so two things. I think of two things as you explained your position there. The first one is, do we want to talk for the next little while about challenging conversations, tough conversations? Yeah. Uh-huh. And then the second thing is your story about your friend's kid reminded me of a situation that happened yesterday. So I'm in the main office, and I go in there to make a call, and I come out of the room. I just made my call, and the admin assistant is on the phone with the parent, and there's a kid standing in front of her, and the kid's rubbing her eye, and she's like upset. There's something wrong with her eye. And the admin assistant's talking to that child's parent and says, oh, I don't have my glasses with me, but But Mr. Chidiak, he doesn't need glasses, so he can take a look. And I have no clue what she's talking about. So I look over and she says, can you please open up her eye and see what's going on in there? And I was like, pardon me? And she said, well, I don't have my glasses. So even if I looked at the child's eye, I'm not going to see anything. I can barely see anything now. So I'm like, okay. And she's on the phone with the parent and she's saying, okay, Mr. Chidiak's going to take a look. Is that okay? And I guess the parent says, sure. And so I say to the child, okay, I need you to move your hand away from your eye and I need you to open your eye. So it just makes me laugh that, you know, we believe that the child had stuck something in her eye, messing around or whatever, and went right in. And then it was too embarrassed to admit that. So I took a look and the eye looked fine. I'm not a doctor. I don't have any really in-depth knowledge about the human eyeball, but from what I could tell, there was nothing on the eye. The eye did not look damaged or anything. So I just said, okay, well, your eye looks okay. So if I were you, I'd probably stop rubbing it and let it do what it does to clear itself up. And let's go from there. And then I walked out of the office. So I walk into the office to make a call. I end up doing an eye inspection and then leaving to go back to my class. That's the world of an elementary school. So challenging conversations. You had some kind of tweet interaction with somebody about something. I'm sorry, I don't remember, but.
Yeah, I can shape that. It was, so when I first started the Squirrels podcast, some of the, I spoke with some teacher candidates. And so this was about a year ago around this time. And at the time I said, you know what, I'd like to check back in as we get closer to 2018, and let's just do, you know, kind of a reunion. So just another round table. So I spoke with the three candidates again, and I wanted to have a conversation that could kind of pull us from that was then, this is now. So some of the questions were around, we called it the reunion episode, and one of the topics that I wanted to land on was, what are some of the challenging conversations that they would like to see happening more often? And each one of the individuals had kind of a perspective on not only their own growth, so they're all becoming something apart from, let's say, the content specialist. They're finding their niches, you know, whether it's student advocacy or sports or digital media. So it's that parallel side hustle that so many teachers now are kind of figuring out that they like to do in addition to being in the classroom and being with the students. So that led to an easy path. It was a very easy path then to say, well, you know, what do those conversations about this next thing that you're involved with look like in some of the spaces that you're in? And that's where we kind of got to the topic. Like, it can be really difficult not only to manage a conversation in general about something that you feel authentically passionate about, but sometimes the topic in itself is just a hard conversation. And there's a lot of professional development, I know, within my board around cognitive coaching and having these, I think it's even called having hard conversations, interviewing techniques, questioning techniques, so that you can, in a very structured way, if you don't feel naturally comfortable with it, in a very structured way, get through a conversation, document, whatever the planning that goes around this. But it was interesting to hear their perspective, because it was funny, in two instances, the hard conversations they wish there was more conversation about are, from where I'm sitting, conversations that are happening. So it just made me reflect on their context as to, you know, why it wasn't happening in their space. So then, yeah, and you connected, you dropped down your Twitter, and back to you. What are you thinking?
Well, it's always interesting. See, in my experience with hard conversations, challenging conversations, is I've gotten a lot of exposure to the topic, the concept, because of the leadership initiatives I've been part of in my school board. So we have a leadership program that assists people in, like, their growth and development around being a leader, becoming a leader, the whole topic of leadership. And so in the evolution of the program, there are three parts, and I've been fortunate enough to be part of another leadership initiative that existed before these three parts were in existence. It always comes up. How do you have these conversations? Why they're important? You know, there's some skill behind it. There's like an art to it. And so the people who are kind of taking us down this journey, they kind of provide us with information and readings and things like that to help us wrap our brain around what this is and why it's so important. And I remember the topic coming up on Twitter with Paul McGuire, a retired principal from Ottawa. And I remember Paul when he was a teacher at my high school. So for me, it's really neat to kind of connect with someone who once taught at the school where I used to go to, then became an administrator, now is a retired educator. And he said something once that has really stuck with me, and I don't know why it didn't stick before, but he said, those hard conversations, those challenging conversations, they're always hard and challenging for the person without the power in the conversation. So for example, if an administrator has to sit down with one of their staff and they're having a hard conversation, his perspective, and I could be getting this all wrong, so I want to put that out there right now, that my interpretation of what Paul said and how he said it could be completely wrong, but it's my perspective based on what he said. You know, he said it's more difficult, it's tougher and more challenging for the person receiving this information. So, you know, it's tough for the administrator to bring it up, but really, there's something there with that power imbalance that makes it more challenging for the person that's in the lower power level to receive this information. So if you and I were working together, both educators, we're at the same power level, you know, for me to have a tough conversation with you is going to look different or feel different maybe than an administrator talking to a staff member or a teacher talking to a student. And that has always stuck with me because it's, I don't know why, but if it's come up in my experience of learning about it, it's never stuck. And so it must have been the way Paul said it. And then the thing about that is that sometimes you don't see these things happening when they should be happening. And that kind of upsets me a little bit too, that you see something happening. And I know people are going to say, well, it probably happens behind closed doors. You don't hear about it. There are some people, there are some personalities that just share everything that they experience every day, all the time, with anybody who walks their way. And so challenging conversations are important. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying they're not. And they are difficult for someone, like from my perspective, when I need to have a tough conversation, a hard conversation, I'm not feeling so pumped about it. I'm not feeling good, even though the situation that has occurred that has led to this conversation needs to happen, it's still not easy. And so anyway, it's that what Paul said was just, it was just something about the way he said it. And I guess the fact that, you know, he was an educator for so long and an administrator for so long that he's had to have them, you know, either they've happened to him or he's had to give them. In fact, I know that they've happened to him. He did tell me a couple of stories about that. And, you know, so he's lived it, having had been part of a tough conversation where he's the one receiving, like it was given to him and he had to deal with it. And, you know, people have had them with me too. And it's never easy to be the one receiving. And when you receive, it's important that you consider who you're talking to, right? Because you want to make sure that you're not being disrespectful in your responses to your supervisor. Like I remember a time having a conversation with a former supervisor where I would respond and I would, several times in that conversation, I would stop and I would say, how are you feeling about my responses? Like, are you feeling I'm being disrespectful? And they said, no, I don't. And so I continued with my path, my thinking, because I never, even though I was miffed and upset about the whole situation, I was not I was not trying, nor did I want to be disrespectful to the individual having a conversation with me. Which, you know, some people would say you had enough, like, in your mind at that time to ask if you were being respectful. I said, yeah, because that was going to compound the situation. It was going to make it 10 times worse. And I wasn't interested in making anything worse. So it's that part. There's always a part that people don't tell you about. Okay. Like, and this is decoded, I guess. There's always a part people don't tell you about. So for example, a new teacher comes to your school and they're going to be working with students that you've worked with before. You don't walk into that teacher's room and say, this kid, and this kid are going to give you problems from day one because of this reason, right? You let the teacher start up, they do their thing. And then 2 months later, they're like, hey, can you tell me about so-and-so? I'm having some difficulty around such and such. And then when you explain it, they say, why didn't you tell me before? Say, well, you know, it wasn't really the time or the place. You're here, you're doing your thing, you're stressed out. Like, you don't need me to come in and start blabbing on about whatever. And it's that part that you don't ever get. You just have to discover it on your own, or it comes up after time and trust have been established. You just don't hear about it. One more thing I want to add, an example for any newbies listening. You know, as a teacher, you belong to a federation. And the federation is there to look out for the teacher's best interest. And if there's a situation, they tell you, oh, you should go and talk to the person that's causing this anxiety for you, or the situation's not balanced. You should go talk to the person. But nobody ever tells you that there's going to be consequences to that conversation that you're going to have with that particular person. You don't just walk in, sit down, have a conversation, and there's no comeback to it. But nobody tells you that. That's something you have to experience. There's something you have to think about before you act. And then you have to weigh and balance everything to really find out what is most important to you with respect to this particular situation that you're dealing with. Is it worth possibly creating a negative relationship with a colleague or a supervisor, right? Is it worth that, or with a parent? Is it worth it? And so sometimes I see young, new teachers, and sometimes not young, new teachers who are older that are just guns a-blazing. And sometimes nobody tells them to just back off for a bit, sleep on it, you know, think about it, reflect on it, talk to people about it without being disrespectful, without breaking any kind of confidentiality stuff. Talk to people, get some opinions, get some ideas here. So that was my thing. All that popped up when I saw it was your sketch note about the podcast you did, the reunion podcast, and I saw challenging conversations, and I thought, you know, do these people know what this looks like in an educational setting? Have they considered the power and power imbalance in these conversations and what that looks like? I'll add one more thing. I have the utmost respect for the people who have had challenging conversations with me and done it in a way where I was literally, I did not get my back up and I did not feel defensive. And I'll tell you why. It's the way they approached it. It's the way that they asked me the questions that they wanted to ask me. It was done. I'm almost embarrassed of how empathetic they were and how humanistic they were in their approach. They took the long way around in order to allow me to keep my dignity, right? In order to allow me to feel like I was being treated in a way that all people would want to be treated. And those tough conversations have sat with me. And not only have those conversations sat with me, but the way that they were done. And I have to say to you that 98% of the time, I do not exhibit the patience that these few individuals exhibited towards me in those conversations. And it humbles me. It humbles me. It's some of the proudest times I've gotten in trouble have been from these people who would tell you, you're not in trouble. I'm I need you to understand something, or I want to understand where you were coming from when this occurred. You know, what were you thinking at the time? What happened before that initial response, or how did you deal with this the last time it occurred? Like, I was almost embarrassed at how awesome they were in trying to maintain me as an individual and not break me apart and not make me get defensive. Instead of getting defensive, I felt like, wow, I really appreciate you taking this much time to deal with me and to make me reflect on whatever I did. And mind you, I had a wonderful trust relationship with those people. I knew that they were there to take care of everybody, not just serve themselves. So that's kind of what came up when I saw that on your paper.
What I like is that, man, so much you threw down on there. You make me think about how hard conversations, sure, they exist, but you can have a whole lot of just regular old conversations leading up to that. And the whole idea that hard conversations exist, or challenging conversations exist as a theme, it's ironic, because I just fall back on in the space of, well, let's just have more conversations, because it's in the practice that you get, well, I would even argue one invalidates the other. You do more conversations, I do believe you reduce the list of hard conversations. If you're looking to jump right to the ninja level and get training in hard conversations, I might argue you could probably take an apprenticeship course just in talking and getting to know people. Like, it doesn't matter. Sometimes I think the hard conversations is like taking the penicillin for the infection that you knew darn well you shouldn't be doing that thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's that really strong kind of medicine. Now, it can be just great professional training too. And that is a thing. But it just, you got me reflecting on the fact that in discussing the challenge of having, let's say, conversations outside of our comfort zone, time and time again, I feel as if individuals, when they're considering outcomes and consequences from, again, quote unquote, these challenging hard conversations, is that there's an automaticity to landing on, but I don't like being confrontational. And that concept of being confrontational, again, I would say that if that's your perception associated with hard conversations, then back it up a bit. Just have more conversations along the way. Talk to as many different people as you can. Do it like what you, I love that, you know, that piece that you said, like, I'm not as reflective as the people that have gotten me in trouble, that have sort of come at me and said, you know, I want to try and walk you through what's going on here. And I'm going to allow you to sort of, like, I'm going to allow you your humanity. I'm not going to take it away from you. I'm not going to sort of, like, try and break you to necessarily have you understand where my perception of a misstep, or the system perception of a misstep, whatever is the thing that started that power conversation, right? And I love how you mentioned there's a compliment in there. You know, you didn't mind getting in trouble with those individuals, because you felt like it really was truly a respectful learning experience. I think about how easily we do that as parents, and how easily we, it's a very parental type of response to me, because I think that's the frustrating thing about being the parent, is trying to find, like, what topics, for me, there isn't a single topic that pops up as a quote unquote parent hard conversation that I haven't had with my kids. I don't double think it. I come at it, I have a combo, check in, maybe a hug, you watch their face, you watch everything. You're differentiating, because one is like almost 10 and one is sort of 7, so you can't deliver the information the same way, sometimes shorter, sometimes longer, but the whole time maintaining their humanity. And I never think to myself when I have to have a conversation like that as a parent with my own children that I'm being confrontational. Now, that can be an interesting dynamic. There just might be that I hold all the power. So I wonder how often individuals in power ever think about it being actually confrontational, because often individuals that tell me they don't want to be confrontational, there is an element in there that they feel like they have no power in it. So they're trying to steal something that is already theirs, whether it's dignity or power, whatever. Man, you got me thinking a lot of stuff on that. But I think part of the answer here is just more conversations, opening up more, getting connected with a wider array of individuals, building capacity, all the kind of edgy jargon. And it brings me back to something that someone shared with me about being a change, like being able to activate change in our world. And I think conversations do lead to change. Talking about, you kind of have to have sort of three pieces to feel like you can, I'll say, safely step into, let's say, a hard conversation. Is one, you got to be informed. So you got to have some information. You got to have the knowledge, whether it's documentation, edits, blah, 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 blah. I think you also have to have a little bit of the moral imperative. So you have to have a strong belief that you want to be in that space and represent your idea. But the third part, though, that's probably the most challenging, is you also have to know and believe that you have a community that supports you. And if you can sort of tap into those three spaces, whether it's a hard conversation or just creating change in your own world, those are all highly energized motivators to move into those spaces. And I think as a young teacher, I would have never, I think I may have said, I don't want to be confrontational because of the ruffling of feathers, despite the fact what I was dealing with, I needed to kind of, I needed help, I needed support. And I think as I've become an older teacher, that I fall more on the, I don't feel it so confrontational anymore. But I think a part of that is because I feel like I've gained more power. And that's where I kind of check myself, because that's a blind spot. If I actually believe that I'm entitled to an opinion and deliver that opinion in a way that I'm pre-approved to be right, that's a bad blind spot, because those are the moments where you just get knocked on your butt. You're like, okay, well, that didn't go well at all. That did not go well at all. That's a good one, man.
Well, you got me thinking. You and your little crew got me thinking. And Paul's words. And hopefully I can use all that. And, you know, when I can speak to the conversations I have with my students that seem to be challenging all the time, is I think I try to provide options and I try to provide that hole, right? That place for their voice. And so because I plan for that, and because I try to do it often, then hopefully the rapport between the two of us is that they understand, they know full well who's got the power, right? They do. I've made it clear. It's me, because I'm ultimately responsible for everything that happens. And so that comes with power, right? But there's room for their voice. It's just, there are certain lines that if they step over, then I have no choice. And maybe I do have choice and I just don't know it yet. Maybe along my leadership journey, I will learn how that works. But right now where I'm at is that sometimes there's no choice. Sometimes it's me and I make the decision and we roll with it. It has to be. Now I say that now, but you know, from six months from now, I could encounter something, I could read something, I could have an interaction with someone who allows me to learn something new, and so my mind can be changed, right? Like I can take my old learning, toss it, and enter in my new learning. So, and that's the thing I try to, pass on to my students, is that being open, right? Being open, being a lifelong learner means that you're always learning new things, and sometimes the new things replace the old things, and you just gotta let them go. So I really appreciate us kind of going back and forth on this, because it makes me aware that I am a lifelong learner, and it's constantly, my OS is constantly being updated to operate in a different way. And some days it's harder to deal with that. Some days I don't want to change. I like the learning I have, but I find that all I need is a little bit more, I need time. And with that time, then I soften up, then I let the new learning enter, and I let the change take flight. But it's not always easy, especially for me. And so it's important for me to acknowledge that. You know, I would love to watch this. I would love if something in the next little while, I learn something new about leadership or whatever, and then I come back to this episode and I listen to what I said and I think, wow, that was so close-minded, you know, Roland, like it's a good thing that you opened yourself up to the new experiences or the new connections. So I wanted to end with you having the final say, but then I ended up talking again.
I got a quick one just to throw down because I think it works so well. I love the, you and I don't often talk about the time traveling of reflective practice and returning to some of the ideas. We kind of drop it in the moment. I think maybe that's where we're sort of stronger in our connection. We're just kind of previously on and we kind of just roll on that. It's like our own stream of consciousness, this podcast in some ways, right? I heard, I'm sure you've been in the car or in spaces long enough where you've heard the playlist come back around on the radio and it's like that song you heard at one time of the day is playing again. You're like, maybe that's speaking to me, like a message from out there. This past week, like I never listen to the radio anymore. Like I'm on podcasts or in silence when I'm driving by myself. But this past week I listened to the radio and there's a song by Macklemore that kept on popping up this week. It was bizarre. It's called The Good Old Days. And it's a pretty sweet track, him and Kesha. And it's got a good hook and her voice is really nice in it. And I like it because he's singing a little bit in it, which is, I kind of like when someone can move between kind of spoken word and they can sing a little bit too. Like it's got some skill. Anyways, the chorus on that, or the background hook, is where somebody had told me that these were the good old days. And it really, I know part of it, it plays out in the combo that I had with those now all, you know, freshly minted teachers just wrapping up their candidacy. One of them in particular is now officially done with Teachers College and is working jobs in EDU and has an interview with a big board, I think. It was maybe yesterday. So there, I say you're now closer. You're further from your start now, you know, and you're in your career. You're officially be calling yourself a teacher. And it's funny how I paused this last week a couple of times thinking about some of the stuff that I preoccupy myself with, and I don't exist in it long enough to fully appreciate some of the coolness of it. And I think about talking with teaching candidates and trying to give them a view of the future, but realizing maybe they might actually forget along the path of how cool it is of what they're doing. So moving into this next week, I'm going to actively, because it is our last week of regular programming, I'm going to try to be in the moment a little bit and acknowledge and honor the successes and sort of the sweetness of what we've established. Because I've come to realize, unless I'm prepared to go back through all my podcasts, I'm not getting any sort of like hints from my past that good things are coming down the pipe. There's no guarantees. So just paying attention to what's in front of you, we can make it simple and say it mindful. But I think I'm going to avoid being overly analytical, which is really difficult for me, and kind of enjoy the sweet spot of that I'm in right there. So that's my next week.
Awesome. Well, I wish you a good one, and I'm sure you and I will be talking before the next podcast. But until then, have a great rest of your weekend. And
You too.
Stay woke.
Yeah, stay woke. That's a good starting point for next. We'll see how woke we are when I hit exam week. Take care, man.
See ya.